Help me welcome our speaker this morning, Jack.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jack, and I'm an alcoholic. Kind of gives standing at the free throw line a whole new meaning. I want to thank Kay. Would have been amazing if, as a kid in junior high and high school, I would have ever imagined when I was throwing free throws that one day my back would be at the basket. At an AA meeting taking place in an igloo. I want to thank Kay for inviting me to participate in the meeting today, and to welcome those of you who are new. I'd like to wish Barbara and my old friend Aunt Christine a happy birthday. When Kay asked me to come to this meeting, and she said it was on near Key Street, I knew that I had an aversion toward that for some reason. I really didn't know what it was. It didn't occur to me until I got here today that my car was broken into about 3 years ago, right on Key near Robertson. And that's really meaningless about whether or not I should want to return to this area, but I have made so many decisions in my life based on that kind of information. I went to a class reunion a few years ago in a very small town where I'm from, and there was a young woman who I had gone to school with who was a cheerleader and president of many clubs and honor roll and all the rest of it in high school, and I was secretly infatuated with her. And all these years later, when I went to lunch with her and a few other people I knew before we had the big reunion bash, and then it ended up that she and I went to the local city park together and just talked for a while, and I didn't really know her that well, but we were having a good time. She's married, has 4 or 5 kids now. But I told her in the park that, just for fun, I told her that when I was in high school with her that I had harbored this infatuation for her for the entire last couple of years that I was there, but that I never wanted to approach her because I felt very insubstantial, and that she was the most, certainly one or two most popular women in school, and she was beautiful, that she was the president of many clubs, and that she was honor roll and cheerleader, and that I just knew I would never be able to relate to her in terms of my emotions. And it stunned me at that moment in the park that she began to cry. And the reason that she cried, she confessed shortly, was because she said, "Oh, Jack, I..." No, she didn't say, "I secretly was infatuated with you." She said, "Jack, the reason that I was in the honor roll and doing all of those things that you have described was because my home life was hell. It was a nightmare. I never wanted to go home. I never wanted to go home." And when I left that meeting, and since, I have often considered all of the decisions that I have made in my life based on what it looked like as opposed to what it really was. That could apply today for you if you are having Christmas blues, as a lot of alcoholics have. I don't happen to be one of them, for very specific reasons. But I would imagine that, you know, the Christmas blues have a lot to do with what I'm supposed to be getting, and why can't it be the way it is for those people? Why can't it be for me the way it is for those people? And the truth of the matter always turns out that it ain't what you think it is with those people. And if you're new today and you're just very sentimental about Christmas, you know, I'm here to remind you that it is still only 24 hours long. And if you're smart, you can actually sleep about 10 to 12 of those hours. And the same goes for New Year's. And I have noticed, if I've ever had any hint of depression around Christmas time, it's usually related to the idea that, well, why aren't I loved and why aren't I having a good time like everybody else? And it's certainly one of the basic lessons that I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, that it's not about whether or not I'm loved at any particular time, it's whether or not I'm loving. And it's not whether or not I'm having a good time, it's whether or not I'm providing a good time for somebody else. And when I come at life from that attitude, it certainly takes my inclination to gripe about things away. It may not particularly make me happier or cheerful. Actually, I knew that the Christmas spirit inundated my soul about a day and a half ago when I realized it really was Christmas, when I was standing in Bullock's and a lady crowded in front of me and I wanted to choke her. And I knew that Christmas was finally here. This is an interesting meeting. I see a lot of people out here that I haven't seen for a number of years from other meetings. As a matter of fact, there's a lady here that I really haven't seen since like my first year of sobriety. And there are people here that I certainly know. People here that I've actually seen in the last 48 hours. It's always nice to see the same people twice in one weekend. There are people probably here from out of town. There are people here that I've seen at other meetings, in malls, grocery stores. Well, it's a miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous that all of these people from all of these different walks of life have gathered together this morning in this room with one common purpose: to viciously judge and ridicule everything that I might say. So have at it. Christmas really doesn't mean a whole lot to me. It wasn't considered a big deal when I was a kid. My parents were from another country, and so we didn't put a whole lot of emphasis on Christmas. Actually, I get a little more depressed during the summer holidays for some odd reason. But I never really, as a matter of fact, the things that most people feel deprived of around Christmas time were the very things that used to make me crazy about Christmas. I usually indulge myself in Christmas if I'm in some sort of a hot romance these days. Otherwise, it just sort of moves on. And I've certainly learned, based on who I am, that if I'm in a hot romance around Christmas time, I'm very careful about what I buy anymore. For my partner, these days I always go the practical. I don't want to buy her anything that she might use with the next guy. I go the practical route, and salad shooter is always a nice item, as opposed to a nightgown or something. But I remember when I was married, perhaps my most alcoholic Christmas was when my wife told me that her relatives were gonna come and stay with us. Three of the relatives were gonna come and stay with us. One of them was my mother-in-law. It was a nice lady. They were going to come and stay with us for the holidays, or for at least 2 days. And I threw a fit. And I came up with a lot of rationalization and reasons why I didn't want those people to stay with us. Why don't we put them up in a hotel or a motel? And she said that would be very cold and it would be wrong. And I know the reason I didn't want them to be there, because I wouldn't be able to drink like I wanted to. That's all it was about, because alcohol was always the center of my life. So that's what motivated me in all social situations. And it turned out what I did was I threw a fit and I left the house and I went to the motel. I was there for like the next 2 days. I just got ripped and smoked dope and drank and felt right the whole time I was there. It was a really sleazy motel on Ventura Boulevard, just awful. And that's why I'm here today. I'm here today because I have a problem when I take a drink of alcohol. And the problem is that when I drink the alcohol, everything changes focus. My priorities change. All of the things that ought to be of importance to me are no longer of importance. My relationships with those I love, my job, my promises, my word, and a lot of things which are very trivial suddenly take on enormous importance for me when I'm drinking. I remember I once got into like a 2-hour argument with my girlfriend's 5-year-old over her hogging the last of the ice cream. If we were going to go to an Italian restaurant that night, I was going to have red wine. That's what it meant. It didn't have anything to do with anything other than I was going to get to have red wine. If there was going to be a picnic, if that had to do with an ice chest full of beer. That's what that was about. Alcohol was the center of my life, and when I took a drink of alcohol, I wanted the next drink. And if you got in the way of that drink, then I would finesse or finagle or scheme or manipulate or do whatever it took so that I could have what I wanted. Now, one of the ways that I try to live my life today is to approach all situations, no matter how small, at least with the thought in my mind that I'm going to come into this situation and think about you and not about me primarily, if I can, if I can pull it off. And it's all a question of numbers. I've brought up my numbers over the years. And I have to ask myself things like that. Whenever I make a decision, perhaps a decision that is housed in some emotion, I have to question whether or not what it is that I now intend to do is kind, loving, or is it even necessary? Now, I have to consider these things today, because I cannot afford to get into hating myself. So I'm afraid of that. I'm afraid of hating myself, because it is when I hate myself that I take actions that are self-destructive. And next to drinking, which is a self-destructive act for me, I don't want to take any other self-destructive acts. We tell people in Alcoholics Anonymous that they should be careful if they're in trouble, don't take a drink. That's not going to make it any better. I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to figure out that taking a drink is not going to make an emotionally complicated and uncomfortable situation any better. It's obviously going to make it worse, which is the reason that I might take a drink. Because when my life is not perfect, when it's not going the way that I want it to go, then screw it. Then screw what's left of it. I don't care if any of it works at that point. And unfortunately, that kind of a take on life is not serving very well. When I was about 8 or 9 years old, I didn't have a lot of toys. I lived in the country, and my neighbor down the street had all the toys, and I used to go over and play. We'd play together, and our favorite toys that we played with this one summer were a red rubber devil about that tall, made out of rubber. This is back in the 50s, and a black rubber monkey. okay? And he took the monkey and I took the devil, and like kids do when they're 9 to 10 years old, we had the adventures of the monkey and the devil every day during the summer. And those toys were expert in their craftsmanship, as toys were back then. You know, you could really see these distinctive features on these toys. And we played with these, and every day when we finished playing, I'd return the devil to this guy, and then I'd go home, come back the next day. And one weekend, he was in a really good mood, and he asked me if I'd like to take the devil home with me. And I said that I would. That'd be great, because it was my favorite toy in the whole world. And so I took the devil home with me that night. I went to bed with it, and got up the next morning in this farm, went out. It was a beautiful day, I remember it. It was breezy and sunny, and I went out and I sat on the stoop of our front porch with this devil in my hand. And I just started to look at the devil, and I started to look around at the climate and everything, and thinking about how I feel, and I've got the thing that I love most in my life, and I thought, life is wonderful. It doesn't get any better than this. And I just started to look at that toy, that rubber devil. And after I scrutinized it for a length of time, I suddenly realized that there was a flaw in its ear. There was just a little hangnail of rubber, just a tiny thing out of whack there on the ear. And I realized that upset me very much. And I wanted to, as my tendency is, to fix it. And so I reached down with my two fingernails and I just pinched that little hangnail off of there. And then I realized I'd taken a little too much off. And now I was even more upset. So I went over to the other ear, took a little off there to try and even them out. And before I knew it, I was going back and forth trying to even them out, and suddenly this feeling of horror swept through my body. Because when I looked at my favorite toy, something I didn't even own, it now had no ears at all. And it was at that moment that I made a decision based on how I felt that I was to subsequently make this kind of decision all of my life, certainly all my drinking life. Because it made sense. I ripped its head off. Now, if you question what that might have to do with my personality in Alcoholics Anonymous, let me just touch on romantic relationships. I can remember an instance when I was sitting with my wonderful wife, who didn't drink. She wasn't an alcoholic, and we were having a very romantic evening together. Having a bottle of wine, of course, I hugged most of the wine and then tried to talk her out of the half a glass that she'd like. And I felt wonderful. We had told each other that we loved each other, but not in the way. It wasn't offhanded, it wasn't casual like it is so many times. This was meaningful. And I felt great, not unlike I did that morning on the front stoop of the farmhouse. And then I found myself looking at my wife and saying, "You love me, don't you?" And she said, "Well, yes, Jack, of course I do. You know that. I said it a little while ago." "Well, let me ask you something. Suppose I were blind. Would you still love me then?" And she said, I don't understand. What are you doing? One of your things?" No, I just am asking. It's a hypothetical question, that's all. "And suppose I were blind and crippled. Would you still love me?" "Jack, what are you doing? This is getting more. What are you talking about? Listen, hear me out. It's hypothetical. I'm in a car wreck. I'm blind. I'm crippled. And I have a speech impediment. Would you still love me?" "Jack, that is morbid. I don't even want to get into this. Just answer the question. What's the big deal?" "All right. Well, look, it wouldn't be you, so I guess, yeah, I guess I wouldn't love you." "You bitch." I knew in my my gut that I couldn't trust you. So as you can see by those couple of examples, I have a tendency to stir up my own trouble, to stir up my own drama. I have some sort of a penchant for drama. I don't know why. It doesn't matter whether I'm drinking or not. I always want to take more of a dramatic route. You know, it doesn't matter how minor it is. Some of you have heard me say that I have a vacuum cleaner at home that has two speeds. And I often wonder, who would use the slow speed? Not any alcoholic that I know, certainly. So when I'm running that machine back and forth on the carpet, and I might notice a kernel of popcorn nestled up against the baseboard, and there's a wastebasket about 3 feet away from the kernel of popcorn. I'm not the kind of guy who's going to go over, pick up the kernel of popcorn, and conveniently toss it into the wastebasket. There's no drama in that. I'll take it, throw it in the center of the floor so I can suck it up at the machine. So every time I take a drink of alcohol, I want another drink and another drink and another drink. And what happens is I certainly don't discover the noble side of me after I've taken my drinks. I have never come out of a blackout doing anything noble. I haven't discovered myself passing out sandwiches on Skid Row when I came out of a blackout. What I did, what I felt like when I came out of a blackout, or certainly the following morning, was ashamed. I felt ashamed. I felt guilty. I felt full of remorse for what I have done. Which leads me to believe that left to my own devices, when I'm not thinking reasonably, I do dark acts. No. And apparently, from watching the news lately, a lot of people are doing dark acts. People are running amok all over the place. It's always interesting when they, you know, finally catch the guy, whoever it is, and whatever heinous crime he's committed, they always interview the neighbor. The neighbor always says the same thing. He was a quiet man. Kept to himself a lot. Whenever I hear that, I always think, you know, I ought to start socializing more. Because I have a tendency to, while other people are out having a marvelous time and, you know, being together and having fun, I seem to get off on staying at home, listening to the hum of the refrigerator, drawing the drapes, you know, watching the tapes. I don't mean the videotapes. I mean the tapes that I seem to play over and over and over again in my head. The tapes that have to do with resentment. You know. That's something I find myself doing often. You know, I haven't got anything better to do. There's nothing like a little sport resentment. I know the book says it's resentment's the number one killer. Sometimes I feel like it's the number one time killer. You know, I sit there and I run things through my head over and over and over again. One of the things I've learned is that I have to tell my sponsor whatever is going on inside of me. And if you're new today and you don't have a sponsor, I strongly suggest that you get one. And if you don't know what that is, there are many schools of sponsorship, and I'm not going to go into all that now, but I'll tell you the one thing that I think is primarily important in the beginning is to just have somebody with whom you feel comfortable that you can talk to. Not comfortable that's going to buy your act, or your con, if you're like me, but somebody who you feel you can tell what's going on to, no matter how ugly what is going on is. Because that's the stuff that eats up my insides when I keep quiet about it. I have to tell the ugly stuff to somebody. It's a lot more about harboring my resentment certainly I've had resentment for the just short of 14 years that I've been sober. And so have those that I have sponsored. There's plenty of resentment in the air. I got to tell somebody about it. It's very important. Because today I have to do things in Alcoholics Anonymous and also in my life that make me feel good about me. They make me feel good about me in a legitimate way. I said earlier that I thanked Kay for allowing me to participate in this meeting. Well, yeah, what does participate mean? Well, today it means that I'm participating behind the podium. But I participate in every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I attend. Because as far as I'm concerned, Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life, and it's very important for me to support Alcoholics Anonymous to the best of my ability and to participate in every meeting that I attend with that attitude, so that if I'm at my Friday night meeting, then I'm participating by sitting there and paying attention to what's going on at the podium. That I'm helping stack the chairs afterward. That I'm not causing a distraction. I have to sing happy birthday when people take their cake, because if I don't, who is? I have to clap enthusiastically, because if I don't, who is? Let them do it? No, that doesn't work for me. I've got to do it. I've got to participate in every meeting that I go to. Of course, this is a lot more fun than stacking chairs. Some of you heard me talk about my cat before. And I'm not... this is tough, because I had to put my cat to sleep. My cat was 22 years old, and her name was Frances. And I've talked about it a couple of times, and I know there's a distinction in the people who I talk to. There's Group A people and Group B people. And if you're Group B people, just bear with me for a second. Because if you haven't been through it, it's just a very tough thing. And the only reason I bring it up at an AA meeting is because, once again, it proves to me that when I am feeling unbelievably intense and uncomfortable emotion, that I don't have to do anything self-destructive. I don't have to say something that hurts somebody. I don't have to take an action that hurts somebody else, you know. But emotions are part of my life, and I don't have any control over it. I do not control my emotions. I control my actions. Therefore, if I'm angry, that's just the way it is, but I don't have to do anything about it. I don't have to be destructive about it. And I went through this process of about 40 days where I had to let go of something that was very important in my life. It was 22 years. Never argued with me. Always went along with me. Always was there no matter what I did, no matter how ugly I got. She was always there. And if you don't think that's an attractive quality for an alcoholic, to have in a friend. And I miss having her around, and I learned a lot from Frances. I learned a lot from Frances, and I would often entertain thoughts of, you know, I wanted to be more like Frances. Yeah, I wanted to be Frances. Because Frances, for instance, was not afraid of anything. There was this creature that was absolutely unafraid of anything in the entire universe for her entire 22 years. That is to say, except when there actually was something to be afraid of. And that's different from me. That's very different from me. When Frances was sitting on the living room carpet and I was reading the newspaper, she wasn't afraid of me. If I got up, walked over to her, got into her space, she was not afraid of me. But if I made a sudden movement or screamed at her, or she panicked, jumped up, ran, hid. That's appropriate behavior. There was something to be afraid of. But it's not like me. Frances is not like me. I can guarantee you that Frances never sat over on the living room carpet, looked over at me while I was reading the newspaper, thought to herself, I can tell by that look on his face, he's going to get up, come over here and start jumping up and down and giving me problems. And you see, I think that way. And around Alcoholics Anonymous, we call that projection. If you don't know what projection is, I have used an illustration for a number of years. It has to do with how I was talking to a female friend, a platonic friend, about 10 years ago. And we were just catching up. We hadn't talked for quite a while. And during the course of the conversation, she told me that she had a guest, a house guest for the weekend. A lady from South America, from the country of Paraguay, was visiting her, and then we talked about some other things. And eventually my platonic friend said, you know, Jack, I haven't seen you in a while. It'd be a delight if you'd come over. And I said, great. So I went over to her house that afternoon, and because she's a normal type woman, it was appropriate for her to introduce me to her house guest, the lady from Paraguay. And so that's what she did. When I put out my hand to meet this lady, I thought, I don't want to live in Paraguay. That's projection. Unfortunately, it's something I do on a regular basis, which is probably the primary cause of the frustrations and anxieties that I have on a daily basis. Because before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought there was an anti-Jack squad, and I have discovered that I'm the anti-Jack squad. And I got to be real careful about how it works in my head, and it never stops. And people have questioned before, you know, when does that kind of thing stop? It doesn't. But how I respond to it is what's important. And today I can tell you, and it's taken me a long time, and for most of the time when that kind of thing has gone on, I think of this as an amusement park. And I come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous to tell you guys what the newest ride is. Okay? And that's what I have to do. I have to lighten up about the things that go on in my head. I have to let them go on and then take the actions that I've learned to take in Alcoholics Anonymous, regardless of what my gut feeling is. I can't afford to have gut feelings. I always thought I could. My gut feelings are wrong. Whenever I make choices based on how I feel, they're usually the wrong choice. You know, love at first sight. There's one. I actually have that kind of under control. It used to be I would just forge ahead, but now I'm able to, you know, if I see or meet somebody at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and I experience that love at first sight emotion kicking in, today I can kind of look at her across the room and just kind of focus above her head for a moment. And I can see a sign there that says 40 miles of bad road. Do not proceed. And I don't have to proceed most of the time, if that's the case, with any of my emotions. It's Christmas time. And there are probably a couple of people in this room right now that are feeling dreadful. If you're anything like I was when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt god-awful. And if you're new, I don't have anything over you. I have nothing over you but the time that I have, a little short of 14 years. What does that mean, a time, 14? I haven't had to take a drink because I felt the way that you might today. That's what that means. That's all it means. That's the only message there really is. The message is, no matter how I feel, no matter what's happening in my life, no matter how much money I make, no matter how much I lose, no matter what is going on in my life, I don't have to take a drink. Doesn't mean I won't. And that's where the 14 years comes in, because when I felt God awful like you might today, I didn't think it was going to go away. I didn't think I could live with it. And for some reason, certainly nothing to my credit, a miracle of some kind, I was able to get through that God awful pain that I felt when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous without taking a drink of alcohol. And somehow a few months down the line, I was able to look back on that experience and notice that I got through it, that it was a faint memory, that it was history. And wasn't that something for the very first time in my life? And then shortly after that, there was some new discomfort, because life doesn't stop when I get to Alcoholics Anonymous. So there was new discomfort. I had to go through that pain, and I didn't take a drink. And for these 14 years, I've had to go through an assortment of uncomfortable, intensely uncomfortable circumstances. And I have not had to take a drink, and rarely had to take a terribly destructive action. And all of that is in my head now. It's all up there. It's all registered. And I sponsor people, and I get to hear their pain. I get to watch them go through it. I get to watch it turn into a faint memory for them. And all of that is registered in my head as well. And I regularly go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I attend the same meetings. And if you're new, I strongly suggest that you go to the same meetings regularly when you find some place that you like. If nothing else, for the reason that you will hear people get up at a podium and talk about pain. And then you will see them a few weeks later be passed, and you won't be able to experience that if you're going to all different meetings. And I have seen people get up at this podium and talk about pain that was much worse than anything that I've ever been through. And I've seen those people get through that pain without taking a drink. And all of that has registered up in my head too. And with all of that experience that I've had in my 14 plus years and my 13 plus years of sobriety, I know something that perhaps you as a newcomer don't know. I know it's going to be okay. And I'm here to tell you that it's going to be okay for you. I know it's going to be okay because I've been through it over and over again. Now maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the worst of it hasn't happened to me yet. Maybe that's going to happen. But that's why I have to keep coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't do it by myself. When the time comes and I just can't make it, then I'm going to have to reach out. And you can reach out if you're new today. You can reach out. You can get through the holiday season. You can get through it all without ever having to take another drink for as long as you do. So welcome, and I hope I see you again.